I have communion with Courtney every time I visit our childhood church. Whether or not she's physically there, I have communion with her in spirit, and it is a beautiful thing. No one else knows that I do this, not even Courtney. The church we grew up in is ridiculously conservative, the kind of church that teaches women and the men who rule over them that women should wear a dress and be quiet in church. And while they're at it, they should be quiet everywhere else too. It may not come as a surprise, but this church also has some pretty strict rules on who can participate in communion. You must be a Christian. You must be a communicating member of a Christian church. You must be able to confess your faith and other silly ideas that I don't think Jesus ever intended. Courtney is one of the loveliest people I've ever met. I've never heard an unkind word cross her lips, and I've never seen her when she isn't smiling, laughing, and offering a hug. She laughs at all of my bad jokes. She's the salt of the earth. Courtney is also developmentally delayed. A rambunctious 12-year-old with the heart and body of a 30-year-old woman. I choked on the sacrament the first time I saw Courtney being denied it. Gagged might be the proper term. The taste of the bread and the wine changing in my mouth. She was passed over. Neglected. Rejected is the proper term. Everyone was partaking in dutiful compliance. Do you get it? She doesn't meet their requirements of communion. Their requirements are beyond bullshit. Our society judges fish on their ability to fly. Our churches should not. Courtney is more loving and more deserving of communion than any of us will ever be. But they can't see what Jesus sees, and they don't feel what she feels. They can't love like Courtney loves. Courtney is also my sister. And I have communion with her when I visit our childhood church by refusing the bread and the wine every time it is offered to me.
Thank you, Bronson, for that story. And thank you, Ben, for that dark song that's also quite encouraging. That story and those lines. And this ritual of bread and wine. What to do with it, because it's hurt so many people, and I love that line. You can swallow, you can spit, you can throw it up, or you can choke on it, but I still need it now. And so that's where I want to head this morning. What do we do with this ancient ritual that has so often been abused, so often has been hard for many of us to swallow? And what I want to do this morning is I want to introduce to you a book by the way of teaching. And this morning will feel more quote heavy than normal. Actually, it almost feels like a book report. I apologize for that. But this book, S. Mark Hyme's Saved from Sacrifice, A Theology of the Cross, has been immensely helpful to me. In it, he offers a Girardian mimetic desire theory of the cross, and has been blowing my mind and helping shape and helping me understand what exactly this crazy ritual is. And so this morning I want to offer us a way forward by concluding our mimetic desire theory series by looking at how this theory can radically shift our thinking about the cross in this ritual. 3 years ago, my brother bought a new house. He moved to Stratford. So he bought a new house on the outskirts of Stratford, lovely little place out in sort of farm country. And of course, you get a new place, you got to invite the family over. And so over we went to check out the new place, to check out how much better his house does than mine. So, you know, the things you sort of do. So we visited there and showing us the lovely property. And he just had this beautiful tree there. Wonderful tree, and I was remarking to him, man, that's a great tree. What a great climbing tree. And of course, his two boys, my nephews, they're like, yeah, it's awesome. We can climb it. I said, let's go climbing. Let's do it. So we started scaling up on the tree. I got to the first lower branches, and I actually was holding Huxley in my arm. I climbed up there with them, thought it was pretty cool. And of course, the boys, they're like 12 and 10, so they started scampering way, 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 way up the tree. And I'm like, hey, You better be careful up there. They're like, yeah, we've done this a bunch of times. And started just hanging out the tree. Myself, my brother was perched up in another tree. They were way up there. And all of a sudden we heard it snap. I looked up, and there was Elias, my nephew, just hurtling towards the earth from at least 50 feet up. And I could hear him scream out, ah! And right at the last moment, holding Huxley, I reached out and caught his arm. And he looked at me and said, whoa. I said, yeah. He said, you saved me. I said, yeah. And then my brother's like, you're Superman. Yeah, I think I might be. I said, you okay? He's like, yeah, I think so. So I put him down, and you know, as sort of kids sort of do after a while, he sort of realized everything sunk in, and he just started crying, even though I had saved him, and ran into his house to his parents. And so I thought I'd better climb down, make sure he's okay. I went in there, and of course, the first thing, my older brother, Troy, he's like, what are you doing? I'm like, what are you talking about? Why are you letting the kids climb that high up in the tree? Started blaming me. I couldn't believe it. You know, I've come to think that heroes and prophets are not welcome in their own homes. So it's me. I'm like, I'm a hero. Well, not quite sure, but if the shoe fits, I suppose. And so it did in this way. I had saved my nephew from certain death. I feel pretty good about that. The thing is this, when we think of saved, being saved, that's normally what we associate being saved with, being rescued from certain death or injury, and it's a fairly straightforward transaction. A fall, someone catches you, you're saved. And it's interesting because Scripture insists that we are in some profound way, we are saved and rescued by Jesus and what he did on the cross. And it's a remarkable thing. But the challenge is that the math and the mechanics of our being saved by Jesus are increasingly looking suspicious to many people. Today, the most popular theory of atonement, what happened when Jesus died on the cross, is called penal substitution theory, which I realize is like, just seems like a fancy term. I like this comic here, a term that only ministers or theologians would use. But what it's trying to get at, trying to not oversimplify things, the math of us being saved sounds a little bit like this. Because we're sinners and we have contributed to the brokenness of the world, God is angry or was angry, or alternatively, our sin created a debt so large that we're unable to pay it. And according to penal substitution theory, what happens on the cross is Jesus steps in and, being the perfect sacrifice, dies in our place as a punishment and cancels our debt of sin. Now, the challenge is that for some people are like, yeah, that sounds good. The challenge for many is that this is becoming troubling to many people. Why? S. Mark Heim, he points out the problem nicely here. Traditional interpretations of the crucifixion are criticized for moral failings, especially the picture they paint of God. If a debt is owed to God, why can't God simply forgive it, as Jesus apparently counsels others to do? If God is ransoming us from other powers, why does God have to submit to their terms? Or if God is wise and compassionate plan for salvation, why does it require such violence? Sorry. These are good questions. Legitimate problems. Let me help you get at the problem. Hear this, because maybe some of you, like, I still don't quite get it. Let's imagine this. Imagine you did something incredibly wrong to me. You really wronged me. Let's say you burned my house down. Right? That'd be pretty bad. And let's say on top of that, not only did you meaningfully burn down my house, you don't have any money to pay for it. And so, of course, I'm angry, right? Because you did this awful thing to me. And so there's this enmity and tension between us. Now, imagine I'm angry, but then you go and you check your mail one day and you've received a letter from me. And what it says is this. Hey, that whole burning down my house thing, yeah, that wasn't very cool. In fact, it made me pretty angry. But I know you don't have the money to pay for it. So what I did is I took my son Huxley and gave him a real good whooping, and now you and I are good. Right? Starts to sound like, That doesn't seem very fair. Yeah, you did this bad thing to me, so I beat up my son, and now you're forgiven. You can start to understand going, it's cool that I don't have to pay for your burnt house anymore, but you might not be totally unrealistic to think I was a bit of a madman for taking my anger on you out on my son, right? And this is the conundrum that many people experience when thinking about the cross today. Being forgiven, well, that's great news. But did it really need to involve violence against an innocent party? So Haim's questions, they're good ones. They deserve a much better explanation because something seems off. And this is, again, where Haim brings in Girard's theory of mimetic desire. And you'll remember that this theory posits, right, that human desires are contagious. And so we imitate the desires of other people. And when that happens, it leads to rivalry and conflict. And when that happens, all sorts of bad things happen. Groups of people, Girard says, are like wildfire. They're just like kindling, just waiting to go off. And so they can be quickly aroused to paranoia and hysteria and panic and even violence. Especially if you look at the world, if there's some sort of stress or crisis on a group, like, say, a famine or an epidemic, this is really kindling, waiting to explode. And so Girard contends this, the scapegoating sacrificed emerged in human history as a way to manage communal violence. He says this, the sad good in this bad thing is that it, scapegoating, actually works. The sacrifice of a scapegoat clears the air. The contagion of reciprocal violence is suspended. A circuit breaker has been thrown. If sacrifice was simply failed science and accomplished nothing, it would have no importance for us now. But it does work and continues to work, whether the community in question is a clique of middle school girls or a country in the grip of economic collapse. The same scapegoating dynamic is alive in our setting. And that system, that human inclination, is what we need saving from. But how? Girard says, well, for that to happen, the scapegoat must find a voice. Scapegoating requires silencing the scapegoat. And so to be saved from our scapegoating, we need to hear the voice of the victim. And Girard makes this incredible claim. He says, this happens for the first time in all of history in none other than the Old Testament. This week was a horrible week with my kids. This is starting to become a theme, isn't it? Evie, she's waking up in the middle of the night and crying. I think we've made a few mistakes. We've given in to her a few times. So she just wakes up and starts crying in the night. And like for a long time, hours. So this past Wednesday, she wake up, cry. And she's gotten clever with her crying. So she'll start with, mommy. And do that for about half an hour. And then there'll be a moment of silence. Daddy. And she'll start saying things like, oh, geez, daddy, help me, come get me. And I'm like, just. I know, she's saying, oh, geez. And I'm like, you got to go to sleep. So Kristen went to bed, and this went on from 10 till 2, and I was losing my mind. I'm like, okay, I'm going to get back up, I'm going to read a book, and just try to ignore what's going on. Leave it over there. Kept going. Just that sound grating on you. And I'm reading my book. A lovely book. Trying to concentrate. And yet that nagging sound there. Eventually I had to go in and sleep on the floor so she would sleep. But here's the thing. I think for Christians, the Old Testament is like an annoying crying baby that you're just trying to ignore. For Christians, the Old Testament is kind of like, just go to sleep. Just quiet down, please. It's like it's there, but you don't really want to deal with it. And so you keep trying to distract yourself. If I focus on Jesus and love, it'll be great. And yet the Old Testament is like this whiny, crying baby going, you can't ignore me forever. What are you going to do with me? I'm right here. And it's like this screaming hot mess for us because the Old Testament is bloody and scandalous to our modern sensibilities. I mean, how can these blood-filled, violent texts play any sort of life in the faith community? How can they play any sort of redeeming role in the life of faith? It's interesting because what Gerard says is this. He's got a startling response. I love it. He says, our scandal, my scandal, your scandal, our scandal at the Old Testament is exhibit A, that we're children of these texts. He says, without the Old Testament, the very moral code you use to indict the Old Testament would not exist. See, according to Gerard, the blood in the Old Testament is actually the key to its interpretation. He says the Old Testament isn't trying to hide anything. The blood is right there, out in front of the story. Haim helps us understand again. He says, what is violence doing in the Bible? It's telling us the truth. The truth about our human condition, about the fundamental dynamics that lead to human bloodshed, and most particularly, the truth about the integral connection between religion and violence. There's no way to be truthful without exhibiting these things. If we complain that the tales are too sordidly familiar human to have any place in religious revelation, we make an interesting admission that they reveal our humanity all too well. We always knew this was the way things were, we claim. We don't need a religious text to tell us so. We need cures, not diagnosis. But is that true? What if our cures need diagnosing? What makes the Old Testament unique is it has the courage to tell the truth, to expose the blood, put it right there in front of us. And the point for Gerard is this. If you want to get anywhere, then you have to start with a bloody God. You have to be honest, which the Bible is. God has been used and is still used as a cover-up for violence. And what the Old Testament has the courage to do is recognize that, and then it starts us on this moral journey. And so he notes that the progression of the Old Testament finds God slowly being disentangled from violence. It starts, he says, as a progression. And not only does it not hide the reality of human violence and bloodshed, he says, here's the key. It gives voice to the scapegoat. That's the great moral achievement, he says, of the Old Testament. Innocent victims begin to find their voice. And so if you follow the trajectory of the Old Testament, the scapegoat begins to speak. And it starts early. I mean, you've got the stories alone of Abel and Joseph, sacrifice of Isaac. They're the perfect scapegoat. They're the innocent victim, and we hear their voice. They're the classic scapegoats. Or then the Psalms, And the Psalms, victims, the persecuted, the ones that history normally silences, they begin to find their voice. Psalm 40 is a great illustration of this. Rescue me, O Lord, from evil men. Protect me from men of violence, who despise evil plan in their hearts, stir up war every day. They make their tongues as sharp as serpents. Their poison of vipers is on their lips. Keep me, O Lord, from the hands of the wicked. Protect me from men of violence who plan to trip my feet. This is unique in history. Normally, we don't give voice to the people being persecuted. Or in the prophetic genre, all of a sudden, we see this growing ambivalence toward the whole sacrificial system. It starts to give voice to the weak and marginalized. In Amos, I hate, I despise your festivals. Cannot stand your assemblies. Even though you bring me burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. Though you bring choice fellowship offerings, I will have no regard for them. Away with the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the music of your harps, but let justice roll on like a river, righteousness like a never-failing stream. Or in Hosea, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. Acknowledgement of God rather than burnt offerings. Or Job, falling in love with this book again. I think we got to go there in season 9. This book is, it's amazing because it reflects on the innocence of the people that we deem afflicted, cursed by God. And you see, this is the thing. For scapegoating to work, you got to have to silence the victim, silence the afflicted. And Job is the perfect scapegoat because in the story, everyone thinks he's guilty. Of course you did something to deserve this. The remarkable thing is Job says, no, He disagrees. Not only that, he's like, I demand a trial. And I want to put God on trial. And suddenly you're going, what is this? This is unheard of. And in the end, God agrees. You're right, Job. Friends are completely wrong. It's fascinating. The victim, the scapegoat, finds a voice. It's amazing the moral journey that the Old Testament takes us on. And it does it by doing something unique and something no other culture had ever done. It gives the victim, the scapegoat, a voice. And so Gerard knows, when you come to the end of the Old Testament, it's deeply conflicted about itself. It's like, need sacrifice, ritual. But there's a deep ambivalence going on. And what Haim points out is that this doesn't find fulfillment until Jesus arrives, specifically in his death. And this is the important part. He says there's two stories playing out at once here. The cross is a paradox. Paradox is the key to a correct understanding of Jesus' death. And so he refers, this is what he calls Jesus' death, stereoscopic. Each speaker has a sound coming out. Two perspectives, two sounds, two stories are happening at the same time in Jesus' death. I drive a 2010 Toyota Corolla, perhaps the most boring car ever created. Gets me to A to B, I suppose, so that's okay. But it's old school. All you fancy people with your hooking your Bluetooth up, you can listen to your music and stuff in there. No, I'm old school. I got to plug my phone in through that thing, USB thing. And our caller's like eight years old now, so it's, you know, it's just hanging on there. But my stereo doesn't work so well anymore. What happens when I'm listening to music is the speakers cut out, and so I'll only get one set of speakers working. And it's amazing to me the way people record music these days. I'm not a musician, but they do so in stereo sound, I've heard. It's crazy. Which means if one of your speakers goes out, you're only hearing half the song. And sometimes it might even mean that the lyrics, the vocals, you don't even get to hear all of them. It's created problems for us because when we're traveling in our car, our kids, like, they love music. And it becomes just a circus in there when the stereo cuts out, starts screaming, hey, we can't hear the song. I'm like, there's nothing I can do. Start hitting the thing, I'm jiggling it while I'm trying to get it fixed. It's driving me nuts. But I can only hear one speaker, and then it'll cut out, I'll wiggle it, the other speaker will come on, and then there's that beauty moment for like 10 seconds where I can hear a whole song. I'm like, oh, just hold it there. Oh, it's frustrating not having a stereo that works. And I think what Gerard is trying to say is that the Old Testament is like a stereo that doesn't work. We're only getting sort of one side of the story. Or Jesus' death. Traditionally, all we hear is one speaker working, but there's a whole other side of the song going on. And one side of the story is this. We're familiar with it. Jesus plays the classic scapegoat. What happens to Jesus in the story of his death is the story of a sacrifice to please God and bring communal peace. I mean, it's right there. Take a look at John 11. This is fascinating to me. You know, the religious elite, they're getting together to talk about what to do about Jesus. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing? They asked. Here's this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. There's the problem. There's an uneasy peace. And then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it's better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. I mean, it's perfectly laid out here as a scapegoat scenario. Have a classic thing. Rome, Israel, share a desire for land. They want the same thing, control of the land, which leads to rivalry and conflict. And right below the surface of the gospel stories is this simmering violence waiting to explode. And in the year 70, it will explode and not end well. But it's simmering there all the time. It could lead to violence at any moment. And what's the thought? Kill him, and we get peace. And it's interesting because you notice when Jesus is brought to trial, he plays the role of scapegoat perfectly. And the trick here is that there's a little reversal going on. It's the clue to the whole story. Scapegoats must be silenced. And what does Jesus do? Mark 14. And the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent. Mark 15, Jesus still made no reply. Jesus remained silent. Jesus made no reply. Jesus gave him no answer. Jesus gave him no answer. He stepped right into the role. You want a silent scapegoat? I'll be the silent scapegoat. And that's one side of the speaker. Jesus, the scapegoat, sacred sacrifice to appease God, bring peace. And yet, Jesus is silent, and in the other speaker, the gospel writers are filling in the blanks, and they're screaming out an important truth. What the gospel writers are doing is they turn the events of Jesus' death into stereo sound, and what we see and hear is this: the scapegoating sacrificial system, believed to be the product and demand of the gods, is now revealed in the gospel for what it really is: the killing of an innocent man by self-interested parties who only wish to retain power and the status quo. And so in the Old Testament, there's this suspicion. I don't think we're hearing the whole song. But they could never quite fix the stereo. But here in the New Testament, everything gets exposed and we hear it in its full stereo sound. The final revelation, the final song is revealed. Scapegoating must end forever because it's simply a ruse and a strategy to accomplish our own goals. And it was as true then as it is now. And scapegoating, whether it happens on a national level, in a communal level, in a group of friends, it's always a ruse for our own self-interested goals. But in the cross, there's one final scapegoat, and that's scapegoating. The sacrifice of Jesus is the sacrifice to end all sacrifices. Like what Richard Beck says, he says, to put the matter crudely, after the crucifixion of Jesus, you just can't kill or silence anyone with confidence anymore. You have to deeply question your motives to consider the possibility that the person you have so righteously nailed to the cross just might be God incarnate. That's amazing stuff. And this is Jesus' saving action. All victims become visible. I like how Haim sums this up here. He says, with the benefit of the long view of history, we can see at least one empirical way that the world has changed in the wake of the gospel. Victims have become visible. No faith is required to recognize this. It's a massive change that we can miss only because it's so encompassing and because we have come to take it for granted. Why is it that Marxism and feminism and the global anti-slavery movement are themselves products of culture shaped by the biblical tradition? Where does this concern for victims, even the recognitions that they should be seen as victims, where does it come from? Given our place in history, those are not self-evident questions. We take them for granted. But Haim's answer is this: it's the cross. It's the cross. And the reason we are capable of even seeing victims today is because of what Jesus did on the cross. And it's through that we are saved from ourselves and our proclivity to scapegoat and blame and do harm and violence to one another. That's huge to me. You know, I get it. Some of you might be thinking, really? Is that really what's going on? Did the first Christians understand this? Well, how again does Jesus' death save us? I want to take you to one final story, perhaps one of the most pivotal stories in all of the New Testament. It's the conversion of Saul to Paul. And it's fascinating in what it reveals to us. When we first encounter Saul, he's another He's at another scapegoating death, the martyrdom of Stephen. They're coming to stone Stephen. We see Saul in this scene, he's holding the coats of those people who are stoning Stephen. In the words of Scripture, Saul was there giving approval to Stephen's death. And soon after, we find Saul pursuing and persecuting Christians. Saul began to destroy the church, going from house to house. He dragged off men and women and put them in prison. So there it is again, scapegoating mechanism. And this new Jesus way is again threatening the peace. It's a threat between religion and Rome, religion and the state. It's violence and harm done in the name of religion. And so after Jesus' death, you get to the first Christian communities, you go, nothing's really changed. Nothing seems to have changed. And by the way, just a side note, lest we be deceived of the foolish notion that it's only religion that causes violence, let's do away with that. Let's remember our history here. Every ideology, every ism in the book has its scapegoating temptations. But here we see Paul scapegoating again, doing the exact same pattern until he travels to Damascus. And some of us know well what happens. Saul's traveling. All of a sudden, he's knocked off his horse by this bright light. He's addressed by a heavenly, mysterious figure. And this mysterious figure calls out to him, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? He says, who are you, Lord? Saul asked. And then, I am Jesus, the one you are persecuting. It's an amazing sequence, and it all comes home to me right here. Who is Jesus? I'll repeat that. Who is Jesus? He's the one you're persecuting. He's the one I'm persecuting. You want to know who Jesus is to you? Identify the person you're persecuting. And this realization by Saul leads to the transformation of the world. We see this revealed in this story here. Through the cross of Christ, God stands with the victims against persecutors. And it's not a fixed thing. You can be a persecutor one day and a victim the next day. Paul's story is an example of that. But if you want to know who Jesus is to you, look inside and ask yourself, who am I persecuting? And how does Jesus save us? By calling us there. I love how Haim sums this up. He says this, Paul will go on to confess that Jesus is the Son of God. His own letters will develop many dimensions of theology, but the simple original substance of Saul's conversion is his change from orchestrating violent animosity against a minority to joining in community with those who were his victims. And this is hardly a minor point, hardly a minor point at all. The voice of the scapegoat is now the voice of God. And the voice speaks against all violence, animosity, persecution, conflict, rivalry, jealousies. I love the final words of Mark Heim's book. It says this, the God who paid the cost of the Christ was not the one who charged it. We are saved from sacrifice because God suffered it. To be reconciled with God is to recognize victims when we see them, to convert the crowd that gathers around them, and to be reconciled with each other without them. I thought this week that might make a good social media strategy. Who are the victims? How do I defuse the crowd gathering around them and be reconciled with them? This is why it's important that we return to the bread and wine. Because this meal, this ritual, it's one of the most powerful acts a church can perform. And why? We do it very rarely here. But it's a symbol that says we here will break bread and wine with anyone. And it challenges us. We will not be the kind of community that silences. We will not be the kind of community that creates enemies and scapegoats so that we can feel good about ourselves. When you dip the bread into the wine and take it, it's a declaration that as a community, we're going to do it the hard way. We're going to take the road less traveled. We're going to walk the way of Christ. And so the ritual of the table for us here is this. It's open to everyone and anyone. We see this practice that we do here as a strong statement. We are all in this together. We're all walking the same path together. We're all equal. We're all worthy of respect and dignity. We are all in need of grace. Here's the thing. There are no enemies here. Just people in need of grace. And this is the profundity of the table. In a world where one is either an ally or an enemy. In a world where we all need to pick sides or our sides will be chosen for us, the ritual of the table says, no, not so with us. I'm going to ask Dave to come and help us play through this ritual. But I see this as such a strong symbolic moral act. From its beginning, the table had served as the practice of having people who are different. People who disagree. People who, outside of these walls, are enemies. People who would never normally associate with one another sit together as equals. And so what it does is it brings real people. It's local. It's concrete. It's actualized. Real people with real differences into a sweaty, intimate, flesh and blood embrace where there shall be no differences among us. And so this is why we do this occasionally here. To remind ourselves. First, we need to be forgiven. For all the ways our proclivity to blame and scapegoat and silence and create animosity. We do this to remind ourselves there's no us and them, it's just us. We do this to remind ourselves that we see and taste and experience Christ in the very act of putting aside our differences in order to break bread and drink wine together with people in this room who are not like us. And may, in fact, people in this room might be the ones we're persecuting. And in this ritual, you know, there's this sort of spiritual act where we come, we experience Christ in a powerful way here. And so in a certain sense, we meet Jesus in the ritual. In the challenge of the bread and the wine, it says, how do you meet Jesus in this ritual? Well, you meet Christ through the one you're persecuting. And so as the band plays, or Dave plays, and just do it simply here. Their table is set up around the periphery of the room. When you're ready, take your time. Just go, take a piece of the bread, dip it in the cup, and then take it. And in doing so, may you know this. Know you're forgiven. You have grace. You are welcome here. And may you know the face of Christ in your victims. The ones you and I persecute. So I'm going to do a simple prayer as we close, and then we will go and participate together, and then Murray will come and close in prayer. Yes, when we've sort of settled a little bit, and Dave will play behind us. But the prayer is simply this. Lamb of God, save me, save us. Let me see my victims. Let me see you, the one I am persecuting. Amen.